cue ball and the reaction of one ball to another in the way a physicist might. He just shot the ball in the right direction with roughly the right amount of force as if he knew the physics. His mind arrived at more or less the right answer. How that happened didn't matter. Similarly, when a person calculates the odds of some situation, he does not do advanced statistics. He just behaves as if he does. When Amos was done talking, Danny was baffled. Was that it? Amos had described the research in the normal way that people describe research done by respected colleagues, said Danny. You assume it is okay and you trust the people who did it. When we look at a paper that has been published in a refereed journal, we tend to take it at face value. We assume that what the authors say must make sense, otherwise it would not have been published. And yet, to Danny, the experiment that Amos described sounded just incredibly stupid. After a person has pulled a red chip out of a bag, he is more likely than before to think the bag to be the one whose chips are mostly red. Well, duh. What else is he going to think? Danny had had no exposure to the new research into the way people thought when they made decisions. I had never thought much about thinking, he said. To the extent that Danny thought of thinking, he thought of it as seeing things. But this research into the human mind bore no relationship to what he knew about what people actually did in real life. The eye was often deceived, systematically. So was the ear. The Gestalt psychologists he loved so much made entire careers out of fooling people with optical illusions. Even people who knew of the illusion remained fooled by it. Danny didn't see why thinking should be any more trustworthy. To see that people were not intuitive statisticians, that their minds did not naturally gravitate to the right answer, you needed only to sit in on any statistics class at Hebrew University. The students did not naturally internalize the importance of base rates, for instance. They were as likely to draw a big conclusion from a small sample as from a big sample. Danny himself, the best teacher of statistics at Hebrew University, had figured out long after the fact that he had failed to replicate whatever it was that he had discovered about Israeli kids from their taste in tent sizes because he had relied on sample sizes that were too small. That is, he had tested too few kids to get an accurate picture of the population. He had assumed, in other words, that a few poker chips revealed the true contents of the book bag as clearly as a few big handfuls, and so he never fully determined what was in the bag. In Danny's view, people were not conservative Bayesians. They were not statisticians of any kind. They often leapt from little information to big conclusions. The theory of the mind as some kind of statistician was, of course, just a metaphor. But the metaphor to Danny felt wrong. I knew I was a lousy intuitive statistician, he said, and I really didn't think I was stupider than anyone else. The psychologists in Ward Edwards's lab were interesting to Danny in much the same way that the psychoanalysts at the Austin Riggs Center had been interesting to him after their patient had surprised them by killing herself. What interested him was their inability to face the evidence of their own folly. The experiment Amos had described was compelling only to someone already completely sold on the idea that people's intuitive judgment approximated the correct answer, that they were, at least roughly, good Bayesian statisticians. Which was odd when you thought about it. Most real-life judgments did not offer probabilities as clean and knowable as the judgment of which book bag contained mostly red poker chips. The most you could hope to show with such experiments is that people were very poor intuitive statisticians, so poor they couldn't even pick the book bag that offered them the most favorable odds. People who proved to be expert book bag pickers might still stumble when faced with judgments in which the probabilities were far more difficult to know. Say, whether some foreign dictator did or did not possess weapons of mass destruction. Danny thought this is what happens when people become attached to a theory. They fit the evidence to the theory rather than the theory to the evidence. They cease to see what's right under their nose. Everywhere one turned, one found idiocies that were commonly accepted as truths only because they were embedded in a theory to which the scientists had yoked their careers. Just think about it, said Danny. For decades, psychologists thought that behavior is to be explained by learning, and they studied learning by looking at hungry rats learning to run to a goal box in a maze. That was the way it was done. Some people thought it was BS, but they were not smarter or more knowledgeable than the brilliant people who dedicated their career to what we now see as rubbish. The people in this new field devoted to human decision-making had become similarly blinded by their theory. Conservative Bayesians, the phrase was worse than meaningless. It suggests people have the correct answer and they adulterate it, not any realistic psychological process that produces the judgments that people make, said Danny. What do people actually do in judging these probabilities? Amos was a psychologist, and yet the experiment he had just described with apparent approval, or at least not obvious skepticism, had in it no psychology at all. It felt like a math exercise, said Danny. And so Danny did what every decent citizen of Hebrew University did when he heard something that sounded idiotic. He let Amos have it. The phrase, "I pushed him into the wall," was often used, even for conversations among friends, explained Danny later. The idea that everyone is entitled to his or her opinion was a California thing. That's not how we did things in Jerusalem. By the end of the seminar, Danny must have sensed that Amos didn't particularly want to argue with him anymore. Danny went home and boasted to his wife, Ira, that he had won an argument with a brash younger colleague. Or anyway, that's how Ira remembered it. This is or was an important aspect of Israeli discussions, Danny said. They were competitive. In the history of Amos, there aren't a lot of examples of Amos losing an argument, and there are even fewer examples of Amos changing his mind. You can never say he's wrong, even if he's wrong, said his former student, Sor Shapira. It wasn't that Amos was rigid. In conversation, he was freewheeling and fearless and open to new ideas, though perhaps more so if they did not openly conflict with his own. It was more that Amos had been right so often that, in any argument, Amos's right had become a useful assumption for all involved, Amos included. When asked for his memories of Amos, the first thing the Nobel Prize-winning Hebrew University economist Robert Oman recalled was the one time he had surprised Amos with an idea. "I remember him saying, 'I didn't think of that,'" said Oman. "And I remember it because there wasn't much Amos hadn't thought of." Danny later suspected that Amos actually hadn't given much thought to the idea of the human mind as some kind of Bayesian statistician. The stuff with the book bags and poker chips wasn't his line of research. "Amos probably never had a serious discussion with anyone about that paper," said Danny. "And if he had, no one would have raised deep objections. People were Bayesian in the same way that people were mathematicians. Most people could work out that 7 times 8 equals 56. So what if some could not? Whatever errors they made were random. It wasn't as if the human mind had some other way of doing math that led it to systematic error. If someone had asked Amos, 'Do you think people are conservative Bayesians?' he might have said something like, 'Certainly not every person, but as a description of the average person, it will do.'" In the spring of 1969, at least, Amos wasn't overtly hostile to the reigning theories in social science. Unlike Danny, he wasn't dismissive of theory. Theories for Amos were like mental pockets or briefcases, places to put the ideas you wanted to keep. Until you could replace a theory with a better theory, a theory that better predicted what actually happened, you didn't chuck a theory out. Theories ordered knowledge and allowed for better prediction. The best working theory in social science just then was that people were rational, or at the very least, decent, intuitive statisticians. They were good at interpreting new information and at judging probabilities. They, of course, made mistakes, but their mistakes were a product of emotions, and the emotions were random, and so could be safely ignored. But that day, something shifted inside Amos. He left Danny's seminar in a state of mind unusual for him. Doubt. After the seminar, he treated theories that he had more or less accepted as sound and plausible as objects of suspicion. His closest friends, who found the change in him shocking, assumed that Amos had always had his doubts. For instance, on occasion, he spoke of a problem experienced by Israeli army officers when they led troops through the desert. He'd experienced the problem himself. In the desert, the human eye had trouble judging shapes and distances. It was difficult to navigate. "That was something that really troubled Amos," said his friend Avishai Margalit. "In the army, you had to navigate a lot, and he was very good at it, but it gave even him trouble. Traveling at night, you'd see a light in the distance. Was it close or far away? The water appeared as if it were a mile or less away. Then it would take many hours to walk to it. The Israeli soldier couldn't protect his country if he didn't know the country, but the country was difficult to know. The army gave him maps, but the maps were often useless. A sudden storm could drastically alter the desert landscape. One day the valley was here, the next day it was over there. Leading soldiers in the desert, Amos had become sensitive to the power of optical illusion. An optical illusion could kill. Israeli army commanders in the 1950s and 1960s who became disoriented or lost their way also lost the obedience of their soldiers, as the soldiers understood that there was a short step from being lost to being dead. Amos wondered, if human beings had been shaped so carefully for their environment, why was their perception of that environment still prone to error? There had been other signs that Amos was less than wholly satisfied with the worldview of his fellow theorists and decision-making. Just a few months before he'd spoken at Danny's seminar, for instance, he had been called back into the army on reserve duty and sent to the Golan Heights. There was no fighting to be done just then. His job was simply to command a unit in the newly acquired territory, gaze down upon Syrian soldiers, and judge from their movements if they were planning to attack. Under his command was Izzy Katznelson, who would go on to become a professor of mathematics at Stanford University. Like Amos, Katznelson had been a boy in Jerusalem during the 1948 War of Independence. Scenes from that year were seared into his memory. He remembered Jews running into the houses of Arabs who had fled and stealing whatever they could. "I thought those Arabs are people like me. They didn't start the war, and I didn't start the war," he said. He'd followed the noise inside one of the Arab houses and discovered yeshiva boys destroying the Arab's grand piano for the wood. Katznelson and Amos didn't talk about that. Those were events best forgotten. What they talked about was Amos's new curiosity about the way people judge the likelihood of uncertain events. For instance, the probability of an attack at that moment by the Syrian army. "We were standing looking at the Syrians," recalled Katznelson. He was talking about probabilities and how do you assign probabilities. He was interested in how, in 1956, moments before the Sinai campaign, the government had made some estimates that there wouldn't be a war for 5 years and other estimates that there wouldn't be a war for at least 10 years. What Amos was pushing is that probability was not a given. People do not know how to do it properly. If, since his return to Israel, there had indeed been a growing pressure along some fault line inside Amos's mind, the encounter with Danny had triggered the earthquake. Not long afterward, he bumped into Avishai Margalit. "I'm waiting in this corridor," said Margalit, and Amos comes to me, agitated, really. He started by dragging me into a room. He said, "You won't believe what happened to me." He tells me that he had given this talk, and Danny had said, "Brilliant talk, but I don't believe a word of it." Something was really bothering him, and so I pressed him. He said, "It cannot be that judgment does not connect with perception. Thinking is not a separate act." The new studies being made about how people's minds worked when rendering dispassionate judgments had ignored what was known about how the mind worked when it was doing other things. "What happened to Amos was serious," said Danny. "He had a commitment to a view of the world in which Ward Edwards's research made sense, and that afternoon he saw the appeal of another worldview in which that research looked silly." After the seminar, Amos and Danny had a few lunches together, but then headed off in separate directions. That summer, Amos left for the United States and Danny for England to continue his studies of attention. He had all these ideas about the possible usefulness of his new work on attention, in tank warfare, for instance. In his research, Danny was now taking people and piping one stream of digits into their left ear and another stream of digits into their right ear and testing how quickly they could switch their attention from one ear to the other and also how well they blocked their minds to sounds they were meant to be ignoring. In tank warfare, as in a Western shootout, the speed at which one can decide on a target and act on that decision makes the difference between life and death, said Danny later. He might use his test to identify which tank commanders could best orient their senses at high speed, who among them might most quickly detect the relevance of a signal and focus his attention upon it before he got blown to bits. By the fall of 1969, Amos and Danny had both returned to Hebrew University. During their joint waking hours, they could usually be found together. Danny was a morning person, and so anyone who wanted him alone could find him before lunch. Anyone who wanted time with Amos could secure it late at night. In the intervening time, they might be glimpsed disappearing behind the closed door of a seminar room they had commandeered. From the other side of the door, you could sometimes hear them hollering at each other, but the most frequent sound to emerge was laughter. Whatever they were talking about, people deduced, must be extremely funny. And yet, whatever they were talking about also felt intensely private. Other people were distinctly not invited into their conversation. If you put your ear to the door, you could just make out that the conversation was occurring in both Hebrew and English. They went back and forth. Amos, especially, always switched back to Hebrew when he became emotional. The students who once wondered why the two brightest stars of Hebrew University kept their distance from each other now wondered how two so radically different personalities could find common ground, much less become soulmates. It was very difficult to imagine how this chemistry worked, said Ditza Caffrey, a graduate student in psychology who studied with them both. Danny was a Holocaust kid. Amos was a swaggering Sabra, the slang term for a native Israeli. Danny was always sure he was wrong. Amos was always sure he was right. Amos was the life of every party. Danny didn't go to the parties. Amos was loose and informal. Even when he made a stab at informality, Danny felt as if he had descended from some formal place. With Amos, you always just picked up where you left off, no matter how long it had been since you last saw him. With Danny, there was always a sense you were starting over, even if you had been with him just yesterday. Amos was tone-deaf, but would nevertheless sing Hebrew folk songs with great gusto. Danny was the sort of person who might be in possession of a lovely singing voice that he would never discover. Amos was a one-man wrecking ball for illogical arguments. When Danny heard an illogical argument, he asked, "What might that be true of?" Danny was a pessimist. Amos was not merely an optimist. Amos willed himself to be optimistic because he had decided pessimism was stupid. "When you are a pessimist and the bad thing happens, you live it twice," Amos liked to say. "Once when you worry about it, and the second time when it happens." They were different people, said a fellow Hebrew University professor. Danny was always eager to please. He was irritable and short-tempered, but he wanted to please. Amos couldn't understand why anyone would be eager to please. He understood courtesy, but eager to please? Why? Danny took everything so seriously. Amos turned much of life into a joke. When Hebrew University put Amos on its committee to evaluate all Ph.D. candidates, Amos was appalled at what passed for a dissertation in the humanities. Instead of raising a formal objection, he merely said, "If this dissertation is good enough for its field, it's good enough for me, provided the student can divide fractions." Beyond that, Amos was the most terrifying mind most people had ever encountered. "People were afraid to discuss ideas in front of him," said a friend, "because they were afraid he would put his finger on the flaw that they had only dimly sensed." One of Amos's graduate students, Ruma Falk, said she was so afraid of what Amos would think of her driving that when she drove him home in her car, she insisted that he drive. And now here he was spending all of his time with Danny, whose susceptibility to criticism was so extreme that a single remark from a misguided student sent him down a long, dark tunnel of self-doubt. It was as if you had dropped a white mouse into a cage with a python and come back later and found the mouse talking and the python curled in the corner, rapt. But there was another story to be told about how much Danny and Amos had in common. Both were grandsons of Eastern European rabbis, for a start. Both were explicitly interested in how people functioned when they were in a normal, unemotional state. Both wanted to do science. Both wanted to search for simple, powerful truths. As complicated as Danny might have been, he still longed to do the psychology of single questions. And as complicated as Amos's work might have seemed, his instinct was to cut through endless bullshit to the simple nub of any matter. Both men were blessed with shockingly fertile minds, and both were Jews in Israel who did not believe in God. And yet all anyone saw were their differences. The most succinct physical manifestation of the deep difference between the two men was the state of their offices. "Danny's office was such a mess," recalled Daniela Gordon, who had become Danny's teaching assistant. "Scraps on which he'd scribbled a sentence or two, paper everywhere, books open to places he'd stopped reading. I once found my master's thesis open on page 13. I think that's where he stopped. And then you would walk down the hall, three or four rooms, and you come to Amos's office, and there is nothing in it. A pencil on a desk. In Danny's office, you couldn't find anything because it was such a mess. In Amos's office, you couldn't find anything because there was nothing there." All around them, people watched and wondered. Why were they getting along so well? "Danny was a high-maintenance person," said one colleague. "Amos was the last one to put up with a high-maintenance person, and yet he was willing to go along, which was amazing." Danny and Amos didn't talk much about what they got up to when they were alone together, which just made everyone else more curious about what it was. In the beginning, they were kicking around Danny's proposition that people weren't Bayesians or conservative Bayesians or statisticians of any sort. Whatever human beings did, when presented with a problem that had a statistically correct answer, it wasn't statistics. But how did you sell that to an audience of professional social scientists who were more or less blinded by theory? And how did you test it? They decided, in essence, to invent an unusual statistics test and give it to the scientists and see how they performed. Their case would be built from evidence that consisted entirely of answers to questions they'd put to some audience, in this case, an audience of people trained in statistics and probability theory. Danny dreamed up most of the questions, many of which were sophisticated versions of the questions about red and white poker chips. The mean IQ of the population of eighth graders in a city is known to be 100. You have selected a random sample of 50 children for a study of educational achievement. The first child tested has an IQ of 150. What do you expect the mean IQ to be for the whole sample? At the end of the summer of 1969, Amos took Danny's questions to the annual meeting of the American Psychological Association in Washington, D.C., and then on to a conference of mathematical psychologists. There he gave the test to roomfuls of people whose careers required fluency in statistics. Two of the test takers had written statistics textbooks. Amos then collected the completed tests and flew home with them to Jerusalem. There, he and Danny sat down to write together for the first time. Their offices were tiny, so they worked in a small seminar room. Amos didn't know how to type, and Danny didn't particularly want to, so they sat with notepads. They went over each sentence time and again and wrote, at most, a paragraph or two each day. I had this sense of realization. Ah, this is not going to be the usual thing. This is going to be something else, said Danny, because it was funny. When Danny looked back on that time, what he recalled mainly was the laughter, what people outside heard from the seminar room. I have the image of balancing precariously on the back legs of a chair and laughing so hard I nearly fell backwards. The laughter might have sounded a bit louder when the joke had come from Amos, but that was only because Amos had a habit of laughing at his own jokes. He was so funny that it was okay he was laughing at his own jokes. In Amos's company, Danny felt funny too, and he'd never felt that way before. In Danny's company, Amos too became a different person, uncritical, or at least uncritical of whatever came from Danny. It didn't even poke fun and jest. He enabled Danny to feel, in a way he hadn't before, confident. Maybe for the first time in his life, Danny was playing offense. Amos did not write in a defensive crouch, he said. There was something liberating about the arrogance. It was extremely rewarding to feel like Amos, smarter than almost everyone. The finished paper dripped with Amos's self-assurance, beginning with the title he had put on it, Belief in the Law of Small Numbers. And yet the collaboration was so complete that neither of them felt comfortable taking the credit as the lead author. To decide whose name would appear first, they flipped a coin. Amos won. Belief in the Law of Small Numbers teased out the implications of a single mental error that people commonly made, even when those people were trained statisticians. People mistook even a very small part of a thing for the whole. Even statisticians tended to leap to conclusions from inconclusively small amounts of evidence. They did this, Amos and Danny argued, because they believed, even if they did not acknowledge the belief, that any given sample of a large population was more representative of that population than it actually was. The power of the belief could be seen in the way people thought of totally random patterns, like, say, those created by a flipped coin. People knew that a flipped coin was equally likely to come up heads as it was tails, but they also thought that the tendency for a coin flipped a great many times to land on heads half the time would express itself if it were flipped only a few times, an error known as the gambler's fallacy. People seemed to believe that if a flipped coin landed on heads a few times in a row, it was more likely, on the next flip, to land on tails, as if the coin itself could even things out. Even the fairest coin, however, given the limitations of its memory and moral sense, cannot be as fair as the gambler expects it to be, they wrote. In an academic journal, that line counted as a splendid joke. They then went on to show that trained scientists, experimental psychologists, were prone to the same mental error. For instance, the psychologists who were asked to guess the mean IQ of the sample of kids, in which the first kid was found to have an IQ of 150, often guessed that it was 100, or the mean of the larger population of eighth graders. They assumed that the kid with the high IQ was an outlier who would be offset by an outlier with an extremely low IQ, that every heads would be followed by a tails. But the correct answer, as produced by Bayes' theorem, was 101. Even people trained in statistics and probability theory fail to intuit how much more variable a small sample could be than the general population, and that the smaller the sample, the lower the likelihood that it would mirror the broader population. They assumed that the sample would correct itself until it mirrored the population from which it was drawn. In very large populations, the law of large numbers did indeed guarantee this result. If you flipped a coin 1,000 times, you were more likely to end up with heads or tails roughly half the time than if you flipped it 10 times. For some reason, human beings did not see it that way. People's intuitions about random sampling appear to satisfy the law of small numbers, which asserts that the law of large numbers applies to small numbers as well, Danny and Amos wrote. This failure of human intuition had all sorts of implications for how people move through the world and render judgments and made decisions, but Danny and Amos's paper, eventually published in the Psychological Bulletin, dwelled on its consequences for social science. Social science experiments usually involve taking some small sample from a large population and testing some theory on it. Say a psychologist thought that he had discovered a connection. Children who preferred to sleep alone on camping trips were somewhat less likely to participate in social activities than were children who preferred eight-person tents. The psychologist had tested a group of 20 kids, and they confirmed his hypothesis. Not every child who wanted to sleep alone was asocial, and not every child who longed for an eight-person tent was highly sociable, but the pattern existed. The psychologist, being a conscientious scientist, selects a second sample of kids to see if he can replicate this finding. But because he has misjudged how large the sample needs to be if it is to stand a good chance of reflecting the entire population, he is at the mercy of luck. Given the inherent variability of the small sample, the kids in his second sample might be unrepresentative, not at all like most children. And yet he treated them as if they had the power to confirm or refute his hypothesis. The belief in the law of small numbers. Here was the intellectual error that Danny and Amos suspected that a lot of psychologists made, because Danny had made it, and Danny had a far better feel for statistics than most psychologists or even most statisticians. The entire project, in other words, was rooted in Danny's doubts about his own work and his willingness, which was almost an eagerness, to find error in that work. In their joint hands, Danny's tendency to look for his own mistakes became the most fantastic material. For it wasn't just Danny who made those mistakes. Everyone did. It wasn't just a personal problem, it was a glitch in human nature. At least, that was their suspicion. The test they administered to psychologists confirmed that suspicion. When seeking to determine if the bag they held contained mostly red chips, psychologists were inclined to draw from very few chips broad conclusions. In their search for scientific truth, they were relying far more than they knew on chance. What's more, because they had so much faith in the power of small samples, they tended to rationalize whatever they found in them. The test Amos and Danny had created asked the psychologists how they would advise a student who was testing a psychological theory, say that people with long noses are more likely to lie. What should the student do if his theory tests as true on one sample of humanity, but as false on another? The question Danny and Amos put to the professional psychologists was multiple choice. Three of the choices involved telling the student either to increase his sample size or, at the very least, to be more circumspect about his theory. Overwhelmingly, the psychologist had plunked for the fourth option, which read, he should try to find an explanation for the differences between the two groups. That is, he should seek to rationalize why in one group people with long noses are more likely to lie, while in the other they are not. The psychologist had so much faith in small samples that they assumed that whatever had been learned from either group must be generally true, even if one lesson seemed to contradict the other. The experimental psychologist rarely attributes a deviation of results from expectations to sampling variability because he finds a causal explanation for any discrepancy, wrote Danny and Amos. Thus, he has little opportunity to recognize sampling variation in action. His belief in the law of small numbers, therefore, will forever remain intact. To which Amos, by himself, appended, Edwards has argued that people fail to extract sufficient information or certainty from probabilistic data. He called this failure conservatism. Our respondents can hardly be described as conservative. Rather, in accord with the representation hypothesis, they tend to extract more certainty from the data than the data in fact contain. Ward Edwards was established, said Danny, and we were taking pot shots. Amos was sticking his tongue out at him. By the time they were finished with the paper in early 1970, they had lost any clear sense of their individual contributions. It was nearly impossible to say, of any given passage, whether more of some idea had come from Danny or from Amos. Far more easily determined, at least for Danny, was responsibility for the paper's confident, almost brazen tone. Danny had always been a nervous scholar. If I had written it alone, in addition to being tentative and having 100 references, I would probably have confessed that I am only a recently reformed idiot, he said. I could have done the paper all by myself, except that if I had done it alone, people would not have paid it attention. It had a star quality, and I attributed that quality to Amos. He thought that their paper was funny and provocative and interesting and arrogant in a way he could never be on his own, but in truth he didn't think any more than that, and he didn't think Amos did either. Then they gave the paper to a person they assumed would be a skeptical audience, a psychology professor at the University of Michigan named Dave Krantz. Krantz was a serious mathematician and also one of Amos's co-authors on the impenetrable multi-volume Foundations of Measurement. I thought it was a stroke of genius, recalled Krantz. I still think it is one of the most important papers that has ever been written. It was counter to all the work that was being done, which was governed by the idea that you were going to explain human judgment by correcting for some more or less minor error to the Bayesian model. It was exactly contrary to the ideas that I had. Statistics was the way you should think about probabilistic situations, but statistics was not the way people did it. Their subjects were all sophisticated in statistics, and even they got it wrong. Every question in the paper that the audience got wrong, I felt the temptation to get wrong. That verdict, that Danny and Amos's paper wasn't just fun but important, would eventually be echoed outside of psychology. Over and over again, economists say, if the evidence of the world tells you it is true, then people figure out what's true, says Matthew Rabin, a professor of economics at Harvard University. That people are in effect very good statisticians, and if they aren't, well, they don't survive. And so, if you are going down the list of things that are important in the world, the fact that people don't believe in statistics is pretty important. Danny, being Danny, was slow to accept the compliment. When Dave Krantz said, it's a breakthrough, I thought he was out of his mind. Still, he and Amos were onto something far bigger than an argument about how to use statistics. The power of the pull of a small amount of evidence was such that even those who knew they should resist it succumbed. People's intuitive expectations are governed by a consistent misperception of the world, Danny and Amos had written in their final paragraph. The misperception was rooted in the human mind. If the mind, when it was making probabilistic judgments about an uncertain world, was not an intuitive statistician, what was it? If it wasn't doing what the leading social scientists thought it did, and economic theory assumed that it did, what exactly was it doing? Chapter 6. The Mind's Rules. In 1960, Paul Hoffman, a professor of psychology at the University of Oregon with a special interest in human judgment, persuaded the National Science Foundation to give him $60,000 so that he could quit his teaching job and create what he described as a Center for Basic Research in the Behavioral Sciences. He never really enjoyed teaching all that much and was frustrated by how slowly academic life moved, especially in granting him promotions. And so he quit and bought a building in a leafy Eugene neighborhood that had most recently housed a Unitarian church and renamed it the Oregon Research Institute, a private institution devoted exclusively to the study of human behavior. There was nothing in the world like it, and it soon attracted both curious assignments and unusual people. Here, brainy people working in the proper atmosphere go quietly about their task of finding out what makes us tick, a local Eugene paper reported. The vagueness of that account became typical of descriptions of the Oregon Research Institute. No one really knew what the psychologists inside were up to, only that they could no longer say, "I'm a professor," and leave it at that. After Paul Slovic left the University of Michigan to join Hoffman in his new research center, and his small children asked him what he did for a living, he would point to a poster that depicted a brain sectioned into its various compartments and say, "I study the mysteries of the mind." Psychology had long been an intellectual garbage bin for problems and questions that, for whatever reason, were not welcome in other academic disciplines. The Oregon Research Institute became a practical extension of that bin. One early assignment came from a contracting company based in Eugene that had been hired to help build a pair of audacious skyscrapers in Lower Manhattan to be called the World Trade Center. The Twin Towers were to be 110 stories and built from light steel frames. The architect, Minoru Yamasaki, who had a fear of heights, had never designed any building higher than 28 stories. The owner, New York Port Authority, planned to charge higher rents for the upper floors and wanted the engineer, Les Robertson, to ensure that the high-paying tenants on the upper floors never sensed that the buildings moved with the wind. Realizing that this was not so much an engineering problem as a psychological one, how much could a building move before a person sitting at a desk on the 99th floor felt it, Robertson turned to Paul Hoffman and the Oregon Research Institute. Hoffman rented another building in another leafy Eugene neighborhood and built a room inside of it on top of the hydraulic wheels used to roll logs through Oregon's lumber mills. At the press of a button, the entire room could be made to rock back and forth, silently, like the top of a Manhattan skyscraper in a breeze. All of this was done in secrecy. The Port Authority didn't want to alert its future tenants that they'd be swinging in the wind, and Hoffman worried that if his subjects knew they were in a building that moved, they would become more sensitive to movement and queer the experiment's results. After they'd designed the room, recalled Paul Slovic, the question was, how do we get people into the room without them knowing why? And so after the sway room was built, Hoffman stuck a sign outside that read Oregon Research Institute Vision Research Center and offered free eye exams to all comers. He'd found a graduate student in psychology at the University of Oregon who happened also to be a certified optometrist. As the graduate student performed eye exams, Hoffman turned up the hydraulic rollers and made the room roll back and forth. The psychologist soon discovered that people in a building that was moving were far quicker to sense that something was off about the place than anyone, including the designers of the World Trade Center, had ever imagined. "This is a strange room," said one. "I suppose it's because I don't have my glasses on. Is it rigged or something? It really feels funny." The psychologist who ran the eye exams went home every night seasick. When they learned of Hoffman's findings, the World Trade Center's engineer, its architect, and assorted officials from the New York Port Authority flew to Eugene to experience the sway room themselves. They were incredulous. Robertson later recalled his reaction for the New York Times, $1 billion right down the tube. He returned to Manhattan and built his very own sway room, where he replicated Hoffman's findings. In the end, to stiffen the buildings, he devised and installed in each of them 11,000 2.5-foot-long metal shock absorbers. The extra steel likely enabled the buildings to stand for as long as they did after they were struck by commercial airliners, and it allowed some of the 14,000 people who escaped to flee before the buildings collapsed. For the Oregon Research Institute, the sway room was a bit of a diversion. Many of the psychologists who joined the place shared Paul Hoffman's interest in human judgment. They also shared an uncommon interest in Paul Meehl's book, Clinical Versus Statistical Prediction, about the inability of psychologists to outperform algorithms when trying to diagnose or predict the behavior of their patients. It was the same book Danny Kahneman had read in the mid-1950s before he replaced the human judges of new Israeli soldiers with a crude algorithm. Meehl was himself a clinical psychologist and kept insisting that, of course, psychologists like him and those he admired had many subtle insights that could never be captured by an algorithm. And yet, by the early 1960s, there was a swelling pile of studies that supported Meehl's initial pie-chucking skepticism of human judgment. If human judgment was somehow inferior to simple models, humanity had a big problem. Most fields in which experts rendered judgments were not as data-rich or as data-loving as psychology. Most spheres of human activity lacked the data to build the algorithms that might replace the human judge. For most of the thorny problems in life, people would need to rely on the expert judgment of some human being. Doctors, judges, investment advisors, government officials, admissions officers, movie studio executives, baseball scouts, personnel managers, and all the rest of the world's deciders of things. Hoffman and the psychologists who joined his research institute hoped to figure out exactly what experts were doing when they rendered judgments. "We didn't have a special vision," said Paul Slovic. "We just had a feeling this was important, how people took pieces of information and somehow processed that and came up with a decision or a judgment." Interestingly, they didn't set out to explore just how poorly human experts performed when forced to compete with an algorithm. Rather, they set out to create a model of what experts were doing when they formed their judgments. Or as Lou Goldberg, who had arrived in 1960 at the Oregon Research Institute by way of Stanford University, put it, "To be able to spot when and where human judgment is more likely to go wrong, that was the idea." If they could figure out where the expert judgments were going wrong, they might close the gap between the expert and the algorithms. "I thought that if you understood how people made judgments and decisions, you could improve judgment and decision-making," said Slovic. "You could make people better predictors and better deciders. We had that sense, though it was kind of fuzzy at the time." To that end, in 1960, Hoffman had published a paper in which he set out to analyze how experts drew their conclusions. Of course, you might simply ask the experts how they did it, but that was a highly subjective approach. People often said they were doing one thing when they were actually doing another. A better way to get at expert thinking, Hoffman argued, was to take the various inputs the experts used to make their decisions, cues he called these inputs, and infer from those decisions the weights they had placed on the various inputs. So, for example, if you wanted to know how the Yale Admissions Committee decided who got into Yale, you ask for the list of the information about Yale applicants that were taken into account: grade point average, board scores, athletic ability, alumni connections, type of high school attended, and so on. Then you watch the committee decide, over and over, whom to admit. From the committee's many decisions, you could distill the process its members had used to weigh the traits deemed relevant to the assessment of any applicant. You might even build a model of the interplay of those traits in the minds of the members of the committee, if your math skills were up to it. The committee might place greater weight on the board scores of athletes from public schools, say, than on those of the legacy children from private schools. Hoffman's math skills were up to it. "The paramorphic representation of clinical judgment," he had titled his paper for the Psychological Bulletin. If the title was incomprehensible, it was at least in part because Hoffman expected anyone who read it to know what he was talking about. He didn't have any great hope that his paper would be read outside of his small world. What happened in this new little corner of psychology tended to stay there. "People who were making judgments in the real world wouldn't have come across it," said Lou Goldberg. "The people who are not psychologists do not read psychology journals." The real-world experts whose thinking the Oregon researchers sought to understand were, in the beginning, clinical psychologists, but they clearly believed that whatever they learned would apply more generally to any professional decision-maker. Doctors, judges, meteorologists, baseball scouts, and so on. "Maybe 15 people in the world are noodling around on this," said Paul Slovic. "But we recognize we're doing something that could be important, capturing what seemed to be complex, mysterious, intuitive judgments with numbers." By the late 1960s, Hoffman and his acolytes had reached some unsettling conclusions, nicely captured in a pair of papers written by Lou Goldberg. Goldberg published his first paper in 1968 in an academic journal called American Psychologist. He began by pointing out the small mountain of research that suggested that expert judgment was less reliable than algorithms. "I can summarize this ever-growing body of literature," wrote Goldberg, "by pointing out that over a rather large array of clinical judgment tasks, including by now some which were specifically selected to show the clinician at his best and the actuary at his worst, rather simple actuarial formulae typically can be constructed to perform at a level of validity no lower than that of the clinical expert." So, what was the clinical expert doing? Like others who had approached the problem, Goldberg assumed that when, for instance, a doctor diagnosed a patient, his thinking must be complex. He further assumed that any model seeking to capture that thinking must also be complex. For example, a psychologist at the University of Colorado studying how his fellow psychologists predicted which young people would have trouble adjusting to college had actually taped psychologists talking to themselves as they studied data about their patients, and then tried to write a complicated computer program to mimic the thinking. Goldberg said he preferred to start simple and build from there. As his first case study, he used the way doctors diagnosed cancer. He explained that the Oregon Research Institute had completed a study of doctors. They had found a gaggle of radiologists at the University of Oregon and asked them, "How do you decide from a stomach X-ray if a person has cancer?" The doctor said that there were 7 major signs that they looked for: the size of the ulcer, the shape of its borders, the width of the crater it made, and so on. The cues, Goldberg called them, as Hoffman had before him. There were obviously many different plausible combinations of these 7 cues, and the doctors had to grapple with how to make sense of them in each of their many combinations. The size of an ulcer might mean one thing if its contours were smooth, for instance, and another if its contours were rough. Goldberg pointed out that indeed experts tended to describe their thought processes as subtle and complicated and difficult to model. The Oregon researchers began by creating, as a starting point, a very simple algorithm in which the likelihood that an ulcer was malignant depended on the 7 factors the doctors had mentioned, equally weighted. The researchers then asked the doctors to judge the probability of cancer in 96 different individual stomach ulcers, on a 7-point scale from definitely malignant to definitely benign. Without telling the doctors what they were up to, they showed them each ulcer twice, mixing up the duplicates randomly in the pile so the doctors wouldn't notice they were being asked to diagnose the exact same ulcer they had already diagnosed. The researchers didn't have a computer. They transferred all of their data onto punch cards, which they mailed to UCLA, where the data was analyzed by the university's big computer. The researchers' goal was to see if they could create an algorithm that would mimic the decision-making of doctors. The simple first attempt, Goldberg assumed, was just a starting point. The algorithm would need to become more complex. It would require more advanced mathematics. It would need to account for the subtleties of the doctor's thinking about the cues. For instance, if an ulcer was particularly big, it might lead them to reconsider the meaning of the other 6 cues. But then UCLA sent back the analyzed data, and the story became unsettling. Goldberg described the results as generally terrifying. In the first place, the simple model that the researchers had created as their starting point for understanding how doctors rendered their diagnoses proved to be extremely good at predicting the doctor's diagnoses. The doctors might want to believe that their thought processes were subtle and complicated, but a simple model captured these perfectly well. That did not mean that their thinking was necessarily simple, only that it could be captured by a simple model. More surprisingly, the doctors' diagnoses were all over the map. The experts didn't agree with each other. Even more surprisingly, when presented with duplicates of the same ulcer, every doctor had contradicted himself and rendered more than one diagnosis. These doctors apparently could not even agree with themselves. These findings suggest that diagnostic agreement in clinical medicine may not be much greater than that found in clinical psychology. "Some food for thought during your next visit to the family doctor," wrote Goldberg. If the doctors disagreed among themselves, they, of course, couldn't all be right, and they weren't. The researchers then repeated the experiment with clinical psychologists and psychiatrists who gave them the list of factors they considered when deciding whether it was safe to release a patient from a psychiatric hospital. Once again, the experts were all over the map. Even more bizarrely, those with the least training, graduate students, were just as accurate as the fully trained ones, paid pros, in their predictions about what any given psychiatric patient would get up to if you let him out the door. Experience appeared to be of little value in judging, say, whether a person was at risk of committing suicide. Or, as Goldberg put it, accuracy on this task was not associated with the amount of professional experience of the judge. Still, Goldberg was slow to blame the doctors. Toward the end of his paper, he suggested that the problem might be that doctors and psychiatrists seldom had a fair chance to judge the accuracy of their thinking, and, if necessary, change it. What was lacking was immediate feedback, and so, with an Oregon Research Institute colleague named Leonard Rohrer, he tried to provide it. Goldberg and Rohrer gave 2 groups of psychologists thousands of hypothetical cases to diagnose. One group received immediate feedback on its diagnoses, The other did not. The purpose was to see if the ones who got feedback improved. The results were not encouraging. It now appears that our initial formulation of the problem of learning clinical inference was far too simple, that a good deal more than outcome feedback is necessary for judges to learn a task as difficult as this one, wrote Goldberg. At which point one of Goldberg's fellow Oregon researchers, Goldberg doesn't recall which one, made a radical suggestion. Someone said, one of these models you built to predict what the doctors were doing might actually be better than the doctor, recalled Goldberg. I thought, oh Christ, you idiot, how could that possibly be true? How could their simple model be better at, say, diagnosing cancer than the doctor? The model had been created, in effect, by the doctors. The doctors had given the researchers all the information in it. The Oregon researchers went and tested the hypothesis anyway. It turned out to be true. If you wanted to know whether you had cancer or not, you were better off using the algorithm that the researchers had created than you were asking the radiologist to study the X-ray. The simple algorithm had outperformed not merely the group of doctors, it had outperformed even the single best doctor. You could beat the doctor by replacing him with an equation created by people who knew nothing about medicine and had simply asked a few questions of doctors. When Goldberg sat down to write a follow-up paper, which he called Man versus Model of Man, he was clearly less optimistic than he had formerly been, both about experts and the approach taken by the Oregon Research Institute to understanding their minds. My article was an account of our experimental failures, failures to demonstrate the complexities of human judgments, he wrote of his earlier piece, the one he'd published in American Psychologist. Since the previous anecdotal literature was filled with speculations about the complex interactions to be expected when professionals process clinical information, we had naively expected to find that the simple linear combination of cues would not be highly predictive of individuals' judgments, and consequently, that we would soon be in the business of devising highly complex mathematical expressions to represent individual judgment strategy. Alas, it was not to be. It was as if the doctors had a theory of how much weight to assign to any given trait of any given ulcer. The model captured their theory of how to best diagnose an ulcer. But in practice, they did not abide by their own ideas of how to best diagnose an ulcer. As a result, they were beaten by their own model. The implications were vast. If these findings can be generalized to other sorts of judgmental problems, Goldberg wrote, it would appear that only rarely, if at all, will the utilities favor the continued employment of man over a model of man. But how could that be? Why would the judgment of an expert, a medical doctor, no less, be inferior to a model crafted from that very expert's own knowledge? At that point, Goldberg more or less threw up his hands and said, well, even experts are human. The clinician is not a machine, he wrote. While he possesses his full share of human learning and hypothesis-generating skills, he lacks the machine's reliability. He has his days. Boredom, fatigue, illness, situational and interpersonal distractions all plague him, with the result that his repeated judgments of the exact same stimulus configuration are not identical. If we could remove some of this human unreliability by eliminating this random error in his judgments, we should thereby increase the validity of the resulting predictions. Right after Goldberg published those words, late in the summer of 1970, Amos Tversky showed up in Eugene, Oregon. He was on his way to spend a year at Stanford and wanted to visit his old friend Paul Slovic, with whom he'd studied in Michigan. Slovic, a former college basketball player, recalls shooting baskets with Amos in his driveway. Amos, who had not played college basketball, didn't really shoot so much as heave the ball at the rim. His jump shot looked more like calisthenics than hoops. A three-quarter speed, spinless shot put which started at mid-chest and wafted toward the basket, in the words of his son Oren. And yet Amos had somehow become a basketball enthusiast. Some people like to walk while they talk. Amos liked to shoot baskets, said Slovic, adding delicately that he didn't look like someone who had spent a lot of time shooting baskets. Heaving the ball at the rim, Amos told Slovic that he and Danny had been kicking around some ideas about the inner workings of the human mind and hoped to further explore how people made intuitive judgments. He said they wanted a place where they could just sit and talk to each other all day long without the distraction of a university, said Slovic. They had some thoughts about why even experts might make big systematic errors, and it wasn't just because they were having a bad day. And I was just kind of stunned by how exciting the ideas were, said Slovak. Amos had agreed to spend the 1970-71 academic year at Stanford University, and so he and Danny, who remained in Israel, were apart. They used the year to collect data. The data consisted entirely of answers to curious questions that they had devised. Their questions were first posed to high school students in Israel. Danny sent out 20 or so Hebrew University graduate students in taxis to scour the entire country for unsuspecting Israeli children. We were running out of kids in Jerusalem. The graduate students gave each kid 2 to 4 of what must have seemed to them totally bizarre questions and a couple of minutes to answer each of them. We had multiple questionnaires, said Danny, because no one child could do the whole thing. Consider the following question. All families of 6 children in a city were surveyed. In 72 families, the exact order of births of boys and girls was girl, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl. What is your estimate of the number of families surveyed in which the exact order of births was boy, girl, boy, 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 boy? That is, in this hypothetical city, if there were 72 families with 6 children born in the following order, girl, boy, girl, boy, boy, girl, how many families with 6 children do you imagine have the birth order boy, girl, boy, 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 boy? Who knows what Israeli high school students made of the strange question, but 1,500 of them supplied answers to it. Amos posed other equally weird questions to college students at the University of Michigan and Stanford University. For example, on each round of a game, 20 marbles are distributed at random among 5 children, Alan, Ben, Carl, Dan, and Ed. Consider the following distributions. In column 1, Alan had 4, Ben had 4, Carl had 5, Dan had 4, Ed had 3. And in column 2, everyone had 4. In many rounds of the game, will there be more results of type 1 or type 2? They were trying to determine how people judged, or rather misjudged, the odds of any situation when the odds were hard or impossible to know. All the questions had right answers and wrong answers. The answers that their subjects supplied could be compared to the right answer and their errors investigated for patterns. The general idea was, what do people do, said Danny. What actually is going on when people judge probability? It's a very abstract concept. They must be doing something. Amos and Danny didn't have much doubt that a lot of people would get the questions they had dreamed up wrong because Danny and Amos had gotten them, or versions of them, wrong. More precisely, Danny made the mistakes, noticed that he made the mistakes, and theorized about why he had made the mistakes, and Amos became so engrossed by both Danny's mistakes and his perceptions of those mistakes that he at least pretended to have been tempted to make the same ones. We kicked it around and our focus became our intuitions, said Danny. We thought that errors we did not make ourselves were not interesting. If they both committed the same mental errors, or were tempted to commit them, they assumed, rightly, as it turned out, that most other people would commit them too. The questions they had spent the year cooking up for the students in Israel and the United States were not so much experiments as they were little dramas. Here, look, this is what the uncertain human mind actually does. At a very young age, Amos had recognized a distinction within the class of people who insisted on making their lives complicated. Amos had a gift for avoiding what he called overcomplicated people. But every now and then he ran into a person, usually a woman, whose complications genuinely interested him. In high school, he'd become entranced with the future poet Daya Ravakovich. His intimate friendship with her had startled their peers. His relationship with Danny had the same effect. An old friend of Amos's would later recall, Amos would say, "People are not so complicated. Relationships between people are complicated." And then he would pause and say, "Except for Danny." But there was something about Danny that caused Amos to let down his guard and turned Amos, when he was alone with Danny, into a different character. Amos almost suspended disbelief when we were working together, said Danny. He didn't do that much for other people, and that was the engine of the collaboration. In August 1971, Amos returned to Eugene with his wife and children and a mental pile of data, and moved into a house on a cliff overlooking the town. He'd rented it from an Oregon Research Institute psychologist on leave. "The thermostat was set on 85, said Barbara. "There were picture windows with no curtain. They had left a mountain of lawn.